might need as a grubstake. I thought of Mother Rachel, she the great matriarch, when she was being brought back to Canaan from her ancestral home in northern Syria. She stole from her father the household idols of the clan, because these were to be offered later as proof of her claims of inheritance. There must be a reason, after all, that the eighth commandment reads, Lo tignov, thou shalt not steal. If Jews didn't steal, there would have been no reason to have such a commandment. And the amount of biblical law, such as I read to you this morning, dealing with thievery and punishment and restitution, is ample, indicating that greed is not limited to the 20th century. Some of these laws are fascinating. It's interesting to see how our fathers tried to develop a society which would cut down on theft, which would limit the inducement to break the rule. In the first instance, they argued that the man who carelessly left goods about, person who left jewels open and in the easily available, was as guilty of the crime of theft as the thief himself. And their principle, and you find this in the Talmud, was a very colorful one. Lo ha'achbara ganav, ela chora ganav. It's not the mouse who is guilty as the thief, it's the hole. If you had not left the goods, no one would have been tempted to take them. They tried to create a society in which there would be little advantage to theft. Therefore, the man who bought stolen goods was as liable to the theft, to punishment, as the man who had stolen the goods in the first place. If there was no buyer, there would be no thief. And they went so far as to say that you may not purchase from a man those goods with which he deals daily in the employ of some other human being. Thus, if I work for a rancher, I cannot sell you goat's milk or hide or flax or wool, because if the price is right, I might be tempted to add to my stock from the stock of my employer. The principle, again, is a figurative and graphic one. You don't put fire near the tow. How did the ganav of biblical days become the ganav? Because it's obvious that the word ganav has overtones, associations, which are not those of simple breaking and entry. There's something, you know, honest about a ganav. There's something dishonest about the medieval ganav. The ganav has the overtones of what? Shrewdness, being too clever by far. The ganav is somehow the embezzler, the man who defrauds, the man who fudges on his taxes, the man who puts too much in this little script of a contract that nobody bothers to read. The ganav almost becomes a term of endearment. When a child wheedled sweets from you, he was a ganav. Now, the word ganav, as it came to be in Yiddish, tells us a great deal about the conditions of life in the ghetto. There was very little to steal. Nobody had much. And if a man stole, he destroyed the unity of the community, which was so necessary to survive. There were very few thieves as such in the ghetto. And they didn't leave the ghetto and go out and thieve in the rest of the city, because if they did, the ghetto itself was liable to massive retaliation. It was not only the thief who was jeopardizing his freedom and his safety, but he was jeopardizing the freedom and the security of his wife and of his children and of his entire community. Now, men have always, I suppose, lived by their wits, and so when you can't go out and take, if you're greedy, you find devious ways, clever ways to do it. So the ganav became the man who did not try to outface you, but he tried to outwit you. And there were such men in all ages of our community, of our various communities. And interestingly, too, the The word ganav tells us a great deal about the stereotype of the Jew among the non-Jew, among the anti-Semite, and among Jews themselves. The Dictionary of Slang will tell you, for instance, that the word ganav appears as early as the 18th century in English as a word which means shrewd and which means Jew. The Jew lived not by his muscle, but by his mind. He was not the physical type, but Shylock, the shyster, the person who would put one over. Conditioning, association, etymology all combined to create this long-lived stereotype, which I suspect still exists, not only among the larger community, but among many of our brothers and sisters, because I still find people in this congregation, as in all congregations, who are absolutely amazed that there are Jews in the prisons of the United States for crimes other than embezzlement and fraud. But there are actually Jewish murderers and Jewish strong arms men and Jewish train robbers, other such dramatic types. Now, my purpose today is not to say, you know, that our thieves are as good as your thieves. Although I would remind you that murder incorporated in the 1920s and 1930s was not an equal opportunities employer, but a very limited Jewish business. And I would remind you that every large concentration of Jews in the United States, the east side of New York, the south side of Boston, in the south side of Chicago, had men who were called Starker, the muscle men, the extortionists, the men who went in and beat up those who were trying to unionize the garment industry, the men who went to those who owned the taxi fleets, to those who ran the horses and the carriages, the draymen and the wagoneers, and said, we will see to it that you are not unionized. You see to it that so much money a week is given to us. We had our gangs, we had our musclemen, we had our gunmen, we had our share of the criminal type. And my purpose this morning is simply this. Crime is very much in all of our minds. You can't turn on the radio today and not be told to lock your car or lose it, to light up your business at night, or to, because light is presumably the cheapest form of security, to bolt your door and to put in all kinds of complicated electronic detection equipment, alarm equipment in your home, so delicate, in fact, that if you move out of bed, the police will come to find out what's wrong. And we have a tendency, as we see our cities becoming violent, as we see our own freedom of movement about our cities becoming more and more circumscribed and limited, we have a tendency to look upon those who are new come to our city in the last 20 or 30 years, those who live in our ghetto, those who show up in the police blotter, to say that the black or the Puerto Rican or the hillbilly is somehow congenitally criminal. That there is something in his culture or lack of it, there is something in his genes or the lack of certain strengths in those genes which makes him a typical criminal. Crime is the result of Huff or of Glenville or of the Near West Side, and let's deal with that rather than looking at its causes in the community. My purpose this morning is to suggest to you that not so very long ago, New York City and elsewhere, it was the Jew, not the black, the Jew and not the hillbilly, the Jew and not the Puerto Rican, who was looked upon as the alien immigrant source of crime, the Jew who was being complained about as every storekeeper, middle-class storekeeper, shuttered and bolted his shop, Jewish crime which was feared by every lady as she walked down from Midtown Manhattan towards the east side, fearful for her life, fearful for her honor, fearful for her person. 1900, 1901, 1905, 1910. During these years, magazines like McClure's, which were something like Life magazine today, came out with revelation after revelation, which accused the Jew, particularly the Russian Jew, of being the criminal element of the city of New York. The Jew was the white slaver. The Jew was the source of gambling, the perversion of the youth. The Jew was the extortionist. The Jew was the man who bribed upright Tammany officials. The Jew was the strong-armed robber. It was because of the Jew that one had to protect himself below 32nd Street. And this wasn't only yellow journalism. In September of 1908, the police commissioner of New York City, a man by the name of Theodore Bingham, published in the North American Review, a very legitimate, high-level publication, an article in which he accused the Jewish community of New York of being the source of one half of the criminal class of New York City. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Substitute black for Jew. Now, the Jewish community rose up in righteous indignation. Down in the East Side, there were massive meetings of protests. Bingham was obviously only an anti-Semite. And in uptown New York, among those who had come in with the German immigration waves of the 1830s and 1840s and 1850s, those who had already waxed prosperous in America, who had become integrated into American society, there were quiet parlor meetings where quiet delegations were appointed to quietly see the mayor in his office, to quietly demand Mr. Bingham's head. And Mr. Bingham was forced to give out a public apology for his article, to recant, and then he was forced to resign. But when later, when all the charges had subsided, unfortunately, Bingham's article had been written in the anti-alien, anti-Jewish language of his class. I'll read you part of it because it's interesting. It is not astonishing that with 1 million Hebrews, mostly Russians in the city, one quarter of the population, perhaps one half of the criminals should be of that race. When we consider that ignorance of the language, more particularly among men not physically fit for hard labor, is conducive to crime. They are burglars, firebugs, pickpockets, and highway robbers when they have the courage. But though all crime is their province, pocket picking is the one to which they take most naturally. Among the most expert of all the street thieves are Hebrew boys under 16 who are brought up to lives of crime. The juvenile Hebrew emulates the adult in the matter of crime percentages. Language is the language of prejudice. The language is loaded and unfortunate. But when the social workers and the statisticians went out to check the courts, when they went out to list the arraignments in night court in New York City over a 6 months period, they found, yes, that Mr. Bingham had exaggerated. It was not one half of the criminal class of New York, which was Jewish, slightly more than a third. We were the thieves and the robbers and the prostitutes and the white slavers and the gamblers and the embezzlers, and those who bribed public officials, and the protection racket boys, the Starker, the muscle men. Now, the second coincidence on which this sermon is based. I happened to come across my desk just 2 weeks ago, just after the Oberlin weekend, a book written by one of these statistics. A man born in 1898 in New York City, who spent 35 of his first 45 years of life in the penitentiary for crimes which ranged from kidnapping to murder to strong-armed robbery. It's a typical kind of book of a man who has spent the better part of his life in jail, who now believes himself rehabilitated and who somewhat over-righteously proclaims his virtue, all the while attempting to sell his book on the basis of his crimes. It's not a very good book. It's called The Goniff, and he was. But what interested me in this book was simply one rather long autobiographical paragraph in which he talks of his youth in the east side of New York. And I cite it to you because it rips apart that overlay of romanticism and nostalgia which the Jews have built up about their ghettos. Somehow the east side of New York was a place where every cold water tenement was kept immaculate by some sacrificial mother, where all the good little children, boys, after school, trudged 5 days a week at 4:30 through the dark to Cheder, where they spent 3 hours learning Hebrew, which they promptly forgot, never getting in trouble on the streets, where every father was working his hands to the bone in order to provide a Harvard education for his son. To us, this is the ghetto. To this Ganef, this was the ghetto. I recall the early days with my family when I was Max M. Friedman, a dirty, snot-running urchin in the teeming jungle of Manhattan's Lower East Side. In 1898, the year of my birth, the East Side was more than the melting pot. It was a catch-all for the immigrants' dreams, made up of lust. Ghettos with their filth and hopes, bedbugs, cockroaches, and inspirations. It was truly a golden Medina, a golden community for the poor Jewish families like ours. My mother, Sarah, was from Germany, tall, almost beautiful, with heavy brown hair that fell to her knees. Nathan, my father, was from Poland, short, stocky, and with a dark beard. Our home was on Orchard Street near Delancey. I ran and stole everything from apples and push carts to laundry off the lines. I was in constant trouble and organized a group of urchin thieves that would have Fagin looked like altar boys. We called ourselves the Jumpers, and we had a cache that included everything from clocks to earrings. In those days, there were no family counselors to work out problems at home. My father was gone much of the time in a lumber buying business, and my mother was always busy with 4 younger children. No father, too many children. Sounds familiar. My family became the tough, loud, ragged little monsters who were proficient in stealing, fencing, and hiding long before adolescence. Only my uncle, Dr. Chaim Lazar, held out any hopes for me. He has a way with the books and the words, Sarah, that Moxie will grow up to be a student. Mama would say that she only hoped that I would turn into a good boychikal. Lazar would contradict her and say, no, that's not enough. He must excel in books and writing and talking. Otherwise, he will wind up in this hole forever. The jungle, the hole, the dirt, the urchins, the thieving, the gambling. At 10, he was in a child's home. At 14, he was in the state penitentiary at Elmira. And for most of his active adult life, he was either in jail or acting out the aggression which would bring him back to jail. Poverty, deprivation, violence, compact humanity, the alienation of the city, all these created among our Jews in New York just 60 years ago a sizable criminal element. And these same causes remain the precipitant cause. Violence and criminality in our society today. Now the third coincidence, another book. This time a book which came across my desk because the National Foundation for Jewish Culture was the group which had underwritten much of the cost of the research and the writing of it. It's written by a man who was then at Columbia University, who is now at the Hebrew University, by the name of Arthur A. Gorin. It's called The Jews of New York and the Beginnings of the Kehillah. Kehillah means federation, community, the organized Jewish presence in a city. And this book is a fascinating book of the attempts in New York City to create a New York federation, a New York Kehillah, in the early days of this century, to wed 2 very disparate groups, the Schiffs The Warburgs, the Marshalls, the wealthy New York Jews of uptown who had the power and the authority and the years of citizenship, and the teeming millions who were just off the boat, who had just cleared Ellis Island, who had landed in the East Side. Some of them had moved to Harlem, others had moved to Brownsville, to Brooklyn, and to Queens. What brought them together? What is the origin of the Federation movement in New York City? Crime. This very, very issue we're talking about. Out of the concern of the community in 1908 for the attacks being leveled by the police commissioner and others, out of that concern, the Jewish community for the first time coalesced and came together for joint action. Oh, there were Jewish institutions before 1908, but the institutions of uptown and the institutions of downtown. Now, for the first time, there was a united community. There was a kihila, as it was called. This was the word that had been used in Germany and Central Europe for federation. And the first activity of this kihila was a department of social morals, a euphemism, if any there be, for a fascinating experience. The Jews of New York organized their own CID, their own criminal investigating division. And they brought together a group of very bright young lawyers whom they hired to go and to live in the ghetto, to live in the East Side, and to spy out on the criminal class, because whom does a criminal class abuse and debase and extort money from but the poor? And to bring to the uptown Jews names, dates, and places. This man is running a house of ill repute at such and such an address. This man is running a gambling establishment behind this storefront. This man is bringing in immigrants illegally and extorting money for them for services which they could get quite naturally from the authorities. And then this Department for Social Morals was taking to the mayor of New York City a list of these criminals, these gamblers, these men who were foisting and living parasites on the Jewish community, and putting them on his desk and saying, now we demand action. These are the years of Tammany Hall. These are the years where policemen up and down the line in New York City as elsewhere were bribed and bought. And the Jewish community knew enough that to know that only if they bypassed the entire police structure, and only if they went to a mayor who owed his election in part to Jewish money, only then could they get the kind of house cleaning in the ghetto which was in fact required. I've heard of many job descriptions for rabbis. One of the most fascinating is that which was the job description of Judah Leon Magnus, who was then the rabbi of Temple Emmanuel in New York. Dr. Magnus, as many of you know, went on to become the president of the Hebrew University. He was a very dynamic, very much alive man who was as much at home in the ghetto of the East Side as he was among his own congregation in central Manhattan. He was married to Louis Marshall's sister, so he had all kinds of entree. He was the rabbi of the leading establishment congregation in New York, and he spoke Yiddish. So they gave Magnus the job of being head of this Department of Social Morals. And day after day after day, the criminals of New York came to Temple Emmanuel to plead their case with the rabbi that he should not give their name to the mayor. They would repent. He had more people on Yom Kippur in his congregation who were beating their breasts in all honesty than Emmanuel has ever had before or since. And for a period of 3 or 4 years, the Jewish community of New York, finally admitting at least to itself the extent of the problem of crime, began to attempt to organize intelligently to deal with it. So out of these beginnings, we have the beginnings of the Federation movement, thus the title of this sermon. But we must go ahead. What broke the back of organized crime among the Jews of New York. In part, the action of the community itself. In part, the action of the society at large, almost the blind reaction of the society at large. First World War came. America moved into an era of great prosperity. The ghetto was able to empty out. There was housing elsewhere. There was better education elsewhere. Young men could find their opportunity without simply being aggressive, beating at the society. The Jews moved out. They moved up in the social ladder. And during the 20s and during the 30s and during the 40s, the criminal population of Jews in the United States, both relatively and absolutely, began to nosedive. So that during the 50s, it was possible in a state like Ohio to go for a whole year without a single Jew being incarcerated in any one of our state penal institutions. In the 1920s, the Jewish rate of delinquency was one-fourth that of the non-Jewish rate. In the 1940s, it was one-sixth. In the 1950s, it was one-seventh. There were, of course, always a small criminal element, but it was small and growing smaller. And so many of us grew up in an era where we assumed that crime and Jews were simply a pair, a pairing off one didn't need to make. And we've come now, strangely, into another era where there is an increase in the Jewish prison population. There is an increase in the number of Jews involved with the courts. But now the cause is not the ghetto, poverty, disadvantage, overcrowding, alienation. Now the cause is suburbia. Abundance, the youth revolution. Some of these people, these Jews who are in prison, are really political prisoners. They are there because they refuse to serve in the army. They are there because of particularly violent forms of social protest and demonstration. But most are not. Most are there because they are delinquents, because they have stolen cars, because they have maliciously destroyed property, because they have smuggled contraband drugs into the United States, because they have pushed drugs among their fellow young people, because they have stolen in order to support a drug habit. Now, we do not have as yet statistics as to the number of Jews, young Jews particularly, involved today in the prisons. We will have them soon. But as any Jewish social worker or rabbi can tell you from his own experience, the rise is swift and percentage-wise significant. Again, we have a lesson. The crime exists when the social conditions are ripe to encourage it. Crime exists because there are weak people and because the society is weak. When the society is strong and is prosperous, where there is opportunity, where there is a sense of movement forward, of social progress, crime diminishes. When there is a sense of confusion, a lack of values, disorientation, crime increases. Now, the rate of the increase of Jewish criminality in the 1960s in the suburbs is no larger, obviously, than the rate of increase among similar young people of similar socioeconomic backgrounds. It has nothing to do with religion as such, and that's really tragic. To have the Jewish home, to have the standards of integrity which we believed, which we were communicating, and not to have statistical difference in our community from the larger community, about the secular community, the community which was not interested in the home as much as we, in character guidance as much as we. It's tragic, and a statement of a failure on our part. I end as I began. The criminal is guilty. Society is guilty. Before we look upon crime as someone else's problem. Before we deal it as something which we must endure, but in which we have no part. Let's remember the degree to which we once were the criminals. Let's remember how much the social context of life creates criminality. And let's do all that we can to create in our society the quality of education, the degree of opportunity, the measure of justice, which will lower the rates, ameliorate the conditions, perhaps reverse the trend which we see all about us, which is fast turning our cities into European-type cities, where one lives within the walls of one's home, and these walls are walls of protection, where one locks himself in a car, in a carriage, to move about the city, where the walls in one's home and in one's business are covered at the top with cut glass, let someone come over them, where one takes the criminal element for granted as part of the inevitable surroundings of life. Men need not be criminal. We give them a chance. That's the obligation of Americans who once gave to all a chance, particularly the obligations of Jews, with our long history and our long tradition. Yes, there are differences in cultural background. Yes, we had more going for us in the east side of New York than some of the newer immigrants into our cities. But if we stumbled, can we not understand their stumbling? And if we found a way out, can we not be hopeful that ways can be found? Crime need not always be among us. But it will be, as long as the society does not feel itself unified, purposeful, active, progressive, combating the social ills which are among us. Ganav or Ganav, whether we fear them, or we accept them somewhat sardonically, they are not my favorite people. They threaten me. They threaten my family. They threaten all whom I love and care for. And if we want to be free of this kind of greed and violence, then let's do all that we can to create the society which will have no reason, which will give no benefit to them, no excuse to them for their actions.